Okay, I forgot to write the statement that I don't have any financial relationships to disclose. Absolutely none. My presentation focuses on the momentous events that took place in two Arab countries, Tunisia and Egypt, starting from November 2010 until I will focus only on Tunisia and Egypt. So basically the first couple of months in 2011. I want to start by just saying a couple of words about language. I use the term revolution. I don't use uprising or revolts because these events represent what the events that took place represent what Charles Tilly, the American sociologist and historian, called great revolutions, as they meet two main criteria. The first is that in both countries, protesters demanded the total dismantling of an existing system and not merely its reform. And the second is that the demands of protesters were anchored in class struggle as a prerequisite for change. Some have argued that the Tunisian and Egyptian revolutions could not have been predicted. Certainly political leaders, the former political establishment in both countries, as well as their allies in the West, were taken aback. However, whether these revolutions could or could not have been predicted, they are critical to understand at this moment and to describe both as singular events, having a revolution in Egypt, what it means for Egypt and the causes and the implications of it, and as universal experiences. For example, a week or a couple of weeks ago, I saw a picture of a young man in New York City holding a sign that says, "This is America's Tahrir Square or Liberation Square." So it's also a universal experience. One can turn to sociological or political theories to try to comprehend not only why this revolutionary change took place in a region that is perceived not to have any democratic structure, but also to understand its timing and to appreciate its spontaneity and magnitude. We might also turn to another discipline that is not much concerned with revolutions, but is heavily involved in understanding how behavior change occurs at the individual level, as well as how community and structural changes influence both behavior and health. The question here is whether one can better understand revolutionary change by employing concepts and theories from the health promotion discipline. So this paper is a work in progress about revolutions and health in the Arab region. The main goal of this work is to explore the question, what would happen if we systematically apply knowledge produced in the health promotion discipline to understand revolutionary change? Would this application help us anticipate or explain a revolution? Better yet, would this systematic knowledge help us instigate or support revolutionary change as a structural intervention to improve health in the same way that others engineer interventions to change, say, smoking or exercise behavior to improve health? One of the critiques launched against the health promotion discipline is that it treats theories as static and rarely, if ever, questions or modifies these theories if they do not corroborate data. Usually, if the data don't work, then the problem is the explanation is that there's a problem in the data and not in the theory itself. In any case, I won't address these complex issues about the health promotion discipline. Today, my presentation will be descriptive, and it will just narrate some aspects of the Tunisian and Egyptian revolutions employing health promotion language and concepts. One of the first questions to ask about any revolution, also according to Charles Tilly, pertains to timing. Why now? Why didn't this revolution happen before or later? What triggered the revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt in 2011, when precipitating conditions have been in existence for decades in these two countries? A simple answer would highlight one specific but powerful event that functioned as a key to action. One young university-educated but unemployed Tunisian man who committed suicide by setting himself on fire in response to poverty, desperation, and humiliation. Living in a town where the rate of unemployment reached 30% in Tunisia, there was nothing extraordinary about this man's situation. His name is Mohamed Bouazizi. His suicide, however, was the spark that ignited a revolution beginning with mass protests in a number of towns that in his town first, that spread to a number of other towns in Tunisia and then spread to the capital city. The regime's violent reaction to these mass protests only led to their increase in number and magnitude. Bouazizi's death became highly personalized. On Facebook, people were posting statements like, we're all Bouazizi. and served in this incident served as a powerful cue to action. The cue to action construct in health promotion explains that in the process of behavior change, often an internal feeling or an external exposure prompts this change, provided it takes place at a time when the balance between benefits and barriers is tipped in favor of benefits. Apparently, here, Bouazizi's death tipped the balance for Tunisians. His image is very powerful and iconic, a young man trying to do what he is supposed to do, but being destroyed by the system. So he was adopted as the poster child of the Tunisian revolution. His death brought about a communal sense of urgency to act against a system in which any Tunisian, young or old, man or woman, could have been Bouazizi. Juxtaposing this image with the most popular image of the Egyptian revolution as one instigated by a few thousand, maybe more than a few thousand, middle-class, urban, and social media-savvy college students. They were called the Facebook kids. Highlights the need to search beyond iconic interpretations of what crystallized the revolution in both countries. Both the personalization of Bouazizi's death and Facebook organizing are, of course, extremely important. But these things took place against an important backdrop of prolonged organizing by many sectors in both societies against state violations of fundamental rights that have been taking place for so long. For decades, populations in the Arab region have been caught between two equally violent alternatives: a pro-Western, corrupt, secular state, and on the other hand, an anti-Western, regressive religious alternative. It's important to emphasize that the protests, for the most part, at the beginning, and later on, for the most part, did not follow any ideological or religious direction, but focused on universal and fundamental rights. Justice, economic rights, and freedom were the most prominent. The revolution focused on the importance of addressing the fundamental social causes of inequalities: lack of participation in political decision-making, neglect, disempowerment, and the list goes on. For many years, Tunisia and Egypt have been laboratories for the enactment of aggressive new liberal capitalist policies in the developing world. The main policy is the ruthless privatization of national resources and services. This led to the concentration of wealth and power in the hands of a few and produced stark social inequalities that have been increasing. It's important to highlight that in order to protect these policies, the regime established a vast apparatus and an expensive apparatus of repression to suppress every form of resistance. The violence of the regime against its population in both countries took place under the protection of Western democracies. This is important to highlight, and in the name of fighting against terrorism. The leading elite controlled and solely benefited from national resources in both countries. The former president of Tunisia, Ben Ali, and his wife's family, for example, were referred to by Tunisians as the octopus whose tentacles wrapped around and controlled practically every economic sector in the country. In Egypt, Mubarak's two sons and a small circle of politicians/businessmen who were known in Egypt as the Fat Cats controlled Egypt's cement, steel, and natural gas industries. One of Mubarak's sons, for example, made a 5% cut on all Egyptian gas sold to Israel, which, by the way, was sold to Israel lower than market price against the will of Egyptians. Both Tunisia and Egypt were reporting economic growth in these fancy international publications. In fact, Tunisia was presented as an African success story in terms of growth and secularism. All the while, a large proportion of the population in Tunisia and a much larger proportion in Egypt, much larger proportion of the population in Egypt earned less than poverty wages. The sign basically says, my salary is £99 a month. What do you expect me to do with this salary? £99 Egyptian pounds is like $25 a month. Tunis reports one of the highest rates of unemployment, with a dangerous mix of having a high rates of university education and high rates of unemployment. On the other hand, in Egypt, with Mubarak focusing most of his energy on prolonging his term as president until his son is ready to take over after his death, job creation to reduce unemployment was clearly not on the political agenda. Demands for reform to increase salaries and improve social conditions have been taking place. In Tunisia, for example, professional syndicates, and this is something that's not necessarily known for people who rely on the traditional media for information about the Arab region. In Tunisia, for example, for almost a decade, there's been large strikes staged by professional syndicates, even a couple of hunger strikes by teachers, demanding better employment conditions and an end to government corruption. In Egypt as well, strikes and sit-ins were prevalent, and they increased in number and in magnitude since 2005. In addition to protests by professional syndicates, there were massive labor strikes in some of Egypt's key industries. In the Mahalla Spinning and Weaving Company, for example, this is the largest publicly owned company, industry in the Arab region, thousands of workers went on strike on many occasions demanding better contracts, higher wages, and health insurance. With time, however, it became clear to many that radical solutions to address the fundamental causes of these social ills and not merely band-aid reform became necessary. The revolutions, in that sense, were to be expected. As the social ills of poverty and inequality were prolonged, the system clearly lost its legitimacy. And the only thing that was keeping the system in power was basically force and violence against the population. So millions of people took to the streets in overwhelmingly peaceful demonstrations. The incidents of violence that took place were perpetrated by the regime itself. Whereas in the case of Iraq, if you remember Iraq, the removal of a dictator took place through occupation and through perpetuating the image that democracy can only be imposed from the outside, the mass protests in Tunisia and in Egypt presented a clear exercise in direct democracy. A couple of days ago, I was watching the news, and Michael Moore was in Oakland, I think, and he made a statement that in relationship to Egypt, and he said that we want direct democracy, not only the right to elect a politician every 4 years, but we want to be involved in the political process. And this is basically what was done in Egypt and Tunisia. The main slogan of both revolutions was the people demand the removal of the regime. By the way, I'm just showing some signs in English. I looked for them, but people were not carrying signs in English. But for the benefit of the audience. So this slogan expresses both a clear sense of empowerment in the part that says the people demand, and a call for a revolutionary or radical change in the part that says the removal of the regime. It calls for change that is based on a qualitatively different relationship between the people and the regime, one in which the people are empowered. The revolution began when people identified the root cause of their problems, which is the regime, the political system in place, and proposed their own solution to address this root cause, not to reform it, but to completely remove it. Empowerment is one of the most fundamental principles in health promotion and a community organizing strategy. It suggests that real change at the community level cannot take place unless members of the community themselves acquire the skills to enact that change. In some of the health promotion writings, empowerment is presented as an important outcome in and of itself, and not only as a process or a tool to achieve other health outcomes. It is just as important as the change that ensues from it. The revolution in Tunisia and Egypt fit into three elements in the classical approach to community empowerment. First, they followed a social action model. Second, they were culturally anchored. And third, they achieved what's called community regeneration and health promotion. Particularly, they displayed what is referred to as the Alinsky method of empowerment in reference to Paul Alinsky's writings on the use of conflict as an opportunity for social change, as an opportunity for social action to achieve change. This is a more involved approach compared to locality development or social planning, which are other strategies in health promotion. The main premise in the Alinsky social action approach is that in cases where there are power imbalances, confrontation rather than conflict resolution increases the chance of achieving social change. Social action enhances a sense of agency at the individual level and empowerment at the community level. The protests in Tunisia and Egypt clearly worked through escalating confrontation, though they remained peaceful. Especially in Egypt, there were numerous calls to stay home or to negotiate with the regime and give it a chance to respond, all of which were rejected by the majority of the groups that were protesting. In fact, empowerment in both countries came as a result of a total distrust and an irreverence for those in positions of power. The revolution put everyone in the there's no going back state of mind, because the goal of removing the regime can only take place through social action. To achieve the goals of the social action project, technology and social media played an important role. Technology was critical to augmenting the revolution, as it enabled Arab youth to organize in virtual spaces because they were prevented from organizing in physical spaces, to capture and display the brutality of the regime's security apparatus on YouTube and Facebook, because they were, you know, these images were not shown on official news, and to speed up the diffusion of the revolution as a structural intervention. Some of the writings on the Tunisian and Egyptian revolutions advanced that they happened because youth became exposed to Western media. A few writers made that statement. Now, acknowledging the importance of technology and the access to alternative media sources, not necessarily Western media sources, it is also important to highlight how culture also contributed to maintaining momentum in these revolutions. Here, what I mean by culture, not as a sense of nostalgia to something from the past, but as daily practices and values that were shared in these revolutions. It's difficult to describe in English how the slogans that were used and the strategies employed in the Egyptian revolution describe so much about Egyptian humor and Egyptian culture. I just show this picture just because it's really difficult to understand. It's difficult to explain in English, but every Egyptian would understand what this picture is about. It's part of the humor and the culture. In protests in Tunisia, the most popular chant people rallied around was not a verse from the Quran nor something borrowed from the French Revolution. It was a line from a poem written by a Tunisian poet who wrote a lot of poetry against tyranny and for empowerment and independence and breaking chains. The same poem was also adopted as a slogan in the Egyptian Revolution. The third point to highlight about these two revolutions relates to how they were moments that led to what's called community regeneration. In the empowerment literature, regeneration is a higher goal to aspire to than community betterment or achieving a specific goal. Through regeneration, members of the community are empowered not only to identify problems and solutions, but to also recognize their own capabilities and what they can contribute towards an alternative social order. For example, shortly after the Tunisian revolution began and the regime labeled protesters as mobsters, neighborhood watch groups were formed in certain areas in the capital and in towns in Tunisia. This is an image of young men at night standing to protect their neighborhood. In Egypt, protesters formed their own checkpoints to prevent mercenaries who were paid by the regime from coming in and causing problems and carrying weapons. Also in Egypt, a Kentucky Fried Chicken establishment, out of all places, was transformed into a makeshift clinic to treat protesters injured by the security apparatus. Finally, after Mubarak stepped down under the weight of the revolution and people began to go home, there was a cleanup campaign to leave. Basically, the slogan for the cleanup campaign was to leave Tahrir Square cleaner than it was before the revolution. So in sum, what happened is the revolution brought out the best in people. It was a process of community regeneration. Contrary to stereotypes of Arab youth as passive and atomized, through the revolutionary experience, they emerged as conscious, engaged, and culturally rooted. So I'll skip one part and I'll just conclude. Let me say that yesterday there was a session organized by the Socialist Caucus in honor of Jack Geiger, and a documentary was shown, and in one part of the documentary, Jack Geiger made the statement that our conception of health is about social change. This was something about southern United States, and we're talking about Egypt and Tunisia. But the statement resonated very much, and I thought, let me incorporate it into my presentation. Over the past year, unprecedented events have been taking place in the Arab region as a whole. Of course, it's not, you know, it began with Tunisia and Egypt. This is a moment when possibilities towards social change, you know, our conception of health as is about social change, there are tremendous possibilities towards this change, though it is difficult to know yet what this change will look like. The Tunisian and Egyptian revolutions achieved some of their goals, one of their goals at least, the removal of the political system. Some people may argue this is not complete. This is a picture of Tunisians voting for the first time in 30 years or more last week. This took place last week, and more than 90% of Tunisians participated in the vote. So political change took place. However, social change we wait for social change to take place as well, and this will require a lot more work because the goals would be to achieve a lot more than just removing one person or a few people from the system. It would require rooting out corruption, ending the mix between politics and financial interests, ensuring fundamental rights for everyone, and building a system that is based on equality, not ideology. I'm sure many of you in the U.S. would identify with that as well. Thank you.